have turned up positive for doping in retests on samples from the Beijing Games. The IOC did not name the athletes or the sports involved. It said today it is notifying the athletes through their national Olympic committees. Florida officials say a mineral overdose is the probable cause of death for 21 polo horses that fell ill as they prepared for a championship match earlier this month. The Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services said today the animals likely overdosed on selenium, a common mineral that can be toxic in high doses. And the Chicago Bulls are on the road tonight to continue their playoff series against the Boston Celtics. It took a double overtime effort Sunday, but the Bulls tied the best of seven series at two games apiece. The teams will face each other Thursday at the United Center, and Game 7, if necessary, will be back in Boston. That's sports.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to attend T-40 and Forward, a celebration of the center's 40th anniversary, on Friday, May 1st. All are welcome to attend this free event. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
In this recession, the International Monetary Fund is ready to loan billions. Fund watchers are especially interested to see what kind of success the IMF has in Latin America. That's a region where the fund was so discredited for pushing its free market orthodoxy that some governments loudly severed relations earlier this decade. Now some of those countries need big loans, and economists say the logical lender is the IMF. NPR's Juan Ferreira reports from Bogota, Colombia.
Money.
In February of 2003, in the remote landlocked country of Bolivia, the people rose up against President Gonzalo Sanchez de Lozada. 30 people died in the failed coup. They rebelled against a tax hike levied to reduce the fiscal deficit, an IMF demand made on Bolivia. Javier Comboni was finance minister then and is now a professor at Wheaton College in Illinois.
The fund wasn't helpful at all. They had a big role on what ended up happening. They were very stringent and adamant on asking the government to place a new tax.
The IMF has its critics worldwide, but nowhere is the fund more scorned than in Latin America. Many leaders blame the IMF for making tough demands that hurt instead of helped. Cuts in spending, devalued currencies, privatizations. Fund loans to Latin America dropped from $48 billion in 2003 to under $1 billion last year. The trend can be attributed to a booming export market. But a new wave of left-leaning leaders also raged against the IMF. Some, like former Argentine President Néstor Kirchner, paid off IMF loans and promptly severed ties. Nicolás Izaguirre is the fund's Western Hemisphere director. He says today's IMF is a new one.
We are emphasizing much more than in the past that the adjustment cannot take place at the expense of weakening the social safety net.
He says a more flexible IMF is making it easier to access loans. And the number of countries seeking loans in Latin America could grow threefold by the end of the year. The idea is to spur spending and improve investor confidence.
If we are willing to put our money where our mouth is, investors should not fear the fund could step in if the countries want with our money. And it's a wall of money. You know, it's a wall of money.
Other multilateral lenders are also offering loans. They include small regional outfits like the Andean Development Corporation and bigger ones like the Inter-American Development Bank, which is based in Washington. The president at the IDB is Luis Alberto Moreno, and he says loan approvals could rise by more than 60% to $18 billion this year.
We have, you know, a very deep reach. We have 26 offices throughout the region, and they love coming to the bank.
But it's the IMF that has the big bucks. Already this year, three Central American countries and Colombia are applying for loans. And the IMF announced that Mexico is receiving $47 billion through its new flexible credit line, an overdraft of sorts that's offered to countries the IMF says have sound economic policies. Nora Lustig is an Argentine economist now teaching at George Washington University.
They
institution that has most of the resources and the flexibility to deploy them of all the multilateral institutions, the financial multilateral institutions, is the IMF.
The big question is whether countries that fell out with the IMF will go back, like Bolivia. In Ecuador, President Rafael Correa's government kicked the IMF out of its office in the central bank. Still, economists in Ecuador, familiar with government policy, tell NPR that finance ministry officials are resuming talks quietly. It's easy to see why. Ecuador is in need of a loan. Juan Ferrero, NPR News, Bogota, Colombia.
It's 2:46. April is National Poetry Month, and one author has come up with a way to make poetry fun for kids. Karen Jo Shapiro has written poetry set to not exactly the tune of famous poems, but the rhythm of the works. You could say in some cases she's pilfered the pentameter. Shapiro talked about her poetry with NPR's Renee Montaigne.
So why don't we begin with an example of your work? You based one poem on Elizabeth Barrett Browning's sonnet, How Do I Love Thee? And I'll read the first few lines of that. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight. And you have a counter poem, a children's version of this, if you will. The title is How Do I Love Ketchup?
Yes, How Do I Love Ketchup? Let me count the ways. I tried it first on burgers and fries. That's all I did for many days until I bought more in a larger size. I tried it on my eggs and toast. Spaghetti, too, sure tasted nice. I add it to all my soups and stews. On vegetables, a little spurt, a dash on fruit, and if I choose, I'll even have it on dessert. And the picture is of the boy putting ketchup on pie and vanilla ice cream, and the kids always go, ew!
So in that poem, in that children's version, you're pretty much sticking with the form, the rhyming scheme, pretty much the original except for all the words.
Most of the time I tried to follow pretty closely with the original, but putting it into kid-friendly and fun and engaging topics for kids.
Let's take another example that's very short. It's called Bubbles.
Mm.
Why don't we let listeners guess what this is and we'll tell them at the end.
Okay. Bubbles. Bubbles, bubbles, singles and doubles, soapy bath in fishy pond, blow some from a plastic wand, here a moment, then they're gone.
Very short little poem with apologies to
William Shakespeare, and that's from Macbeth. Bubble, bubble, toil and trouble. And when I do this with kids, we pretend to be blowing bubbles from a wand. I do this with the preschool. Because I do these poems with kids of all ages, from preschool up through like middle school, and it could be for high school. But with the little kids, we pretend we're blowing bubbles from a wand when we do this one.
Well, how did you get this idea?
When my daughter was three, I decided that I really wanted to get serious about writing a children's book, and I had actually studied the classics when I was an English major, and it all came together for me. I thought it would be really fun if I could take the classical poems and change them around and make them kid-friendly. So I took some poems that I remembered pretty well from my English major, like A Red, Red Rose, which is by Robert Burns. Oh, my love is like a red, red rose that's newly sprung in June. And it came to me that I could do, oh, my nose is like a red, red rose that's newly burnt in June. And so I would do it, I would sort of say the poems out loud. I would go through classical poems in my mind and then kind of work out my own versions. And bit by bit, a couple of them would come together. And by the time I had 10 of them, I knew that it was something I really wanted to do, that I really wanted to work on it and get the whole collection.
Well, this would clearly seem to be a lot of fun for the parents who would know the originals that you were making a play on. But what about kids? Aside from the fun of the poems, blowing the bubbles and whatnot, if they don't know the originals, what are they getting out of them?
Well, that's a great question. I always meant the books to work on two levels at the same time. And so the poems stand alone. I go in, you know, and read them to kindergartners, first graders, second graders who have never heard of William Shakespeare. And they just appreciate this funny story, you know, eating ketchup or eating macaroni and cheese. And they appreciate it at that level. But what I wanted to give them that was extra is that it has these beautiful meters and rhythms taken from such wonderful writers like Edgar Allan Poe. I mean, I just love his rhythms, and Emily Dickinson. And so kids that are younger can get that out of it. The older kids, the middle schoolers that are just starting to learn about some of these famous poets, it kind of gives them an entryway or a way to connect with poets whose language is often difficult. And so this gives them a way to see that they can connect to poems in a more familiar way. And I also feel sometimes like, oh, it's just all so serious. You know, like Emily Dickinson, who wrote that she wrote a letter to the world that never wrote to her. So I turned around and wrote about, you know, this is my letter from the world that it once wrote to me. So in some ways, I kind of wanted to make a healing experience because her poem's so sad to me.
Well, in that spirit, why don't we finish up with a quite a famously dark poem, Edgar Allan Poe's Annabel Lee, and see how you've changed it into something quite in the opposite spirit.
Macaroni and cheese. With apologies to Edgar Allan Poe, Annabel Lee. It was many and many a week ago that I and my sister Louise first tried out a food that you might know called macaroni and cheese. Now I was so hungry and she was so hungry, we ate it as fast as you please. When we emptied our plates, we said, boy, that was great. Let's have more macaroni and cheese. Now the moon never beams without bringing us dreams of macaroni and cheese. And the stars never rise, but you'll hear our loud cries for macaroni and cheese. And every noon, we sing a bright tune, for we know we'll be eating it soon. No matter how others will marvel or tease, we eat macaroni and cheese.
Karen Jo Shapiro has written two books of poetry for kids set to the rhythm of the world's most popular poems, Because I Could Not Stop My Bike and I Must Go Down to the Beach Again. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Okay? Happy Poetry Month.
Karen Jo Shapiro spoke with Morning Edition host Renee Montaigne. Well, say the word octomom, and who comes to mind? Nadia Suleiman hopes that those at the United States Patent and Trademark Office would agree that it's hers, commentator Amy Guida explains in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News. Octomom is trying to trademark that word.
The word octomom wasn't one you heard very often, if at all, before January of this year. I looked in a news database and couldn't find a single mention of the word before 2009. But now the woman from California who had eight babies to much public criticism has the perfect nickname. And the nickname may soon become more than that. She's attempting to trademark the word octomom. A trademark is, and this is the official definition from the United States Patent and Trademark Office, a word, phrase, symbol, or design, or a combination of words, phrases, symbols, or designs that identifies and distinguishes the source of the goods of one party from those of others. Trademark registration puts others on constructive notice that you've claimed rights to the word yourself and that you intend to use the word somehow to your benefit. The classic example is the registered trademark Kleenex, or, quoting directly off a package, Kleenex brand tissue. Kimberly-Clark Corporation has tried to see to it that Kleenex itself never officially becomes a generic word. Kleenex is a registered trademark and means that any company that creates its own type of facial tissue can't call the facial tissue Kleenex, even though the word Kleenex might get the point across more quickly. Octomom has set out to trademark her word so that others who would make products, including the diapers, dresses, pants, and shirts she plans, would be on notice that the word belongs to her. She's also claimed the rights to this intriguing Octomom good or service on another related trademark form that her attorneys filed, entertainment in the nature of ongoing television programs in the field of verity. But there could be a bit of drama to this non-televised Octomom saga. In mid-March, 1 month before Octomom herself began the trademark registration process, something that calls itself Super Happy Fun Fun Incorporated also applied for the Octomom mark. It lists action figures, kites, and yo-yos as among its possible Octomom goods and services. The real Octomom, of course, argues that the company has no right to register that mark or to use that word because within the past few months, that name has come to mean her. It'll be up to the Patent and Trademark Office to sort things out. Attorneys there research and investigate before they register any mark and can deny those that aren't appropriate for various reasons. Meantime, there have been a number of octo words filed with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office over the years, including octopod and octoblimp, two words that Octomom may wish to claim, considering that they likely describe two stages of her remarkable pregnancy. I'm Amy Guida.
Amy Guida is an assistant professor of journalism and law at the University of Illinois. Coming up at 3, it's The World from PRI. Today, global fears about swine flu are traveling faster than the virus. People far from Mexico are concerned about a potential pandemic. Many across Asia remember the SARS outbreak of 2003 and its effect on Asian economies. Examining the financial fallout over the flu, coming up this afternoon on The World at 3 o'clock here on AM 580. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to a generous gift, from Robert and Alice Campbell.
Earth and Sky.
Geophysicist John Goff has studied some of the slim barrier islands running parallel to the Texas coast, including Galveston Island. He said those islands were badly damaged in September of 2008 by Hurricane Ike, which made landfall near the city of Galveston.
It was a tremendous loss of sand, and sand is the critical component to maintaining the health of the system.
Goff mapped the sea floor between barrier islands before and after Hurricane Ike. He said the most erosion occurred when the hurricane subsided as water rushed out of an overflowing Galveston Bay back into the Gulf of Mexico.
The back surge was very important, and that we found was a very, very strong force. It moved a large amount of sediment and eroded a lot of the sand. Those sands are really critical for maintaining the beach barrier system. And without it, if you reduce it, it's very hard to get it back.
The city of Galveston sits on a barrier island. Hurricane Ike sent a storm surge over the city that reached 20 feet over 6 meters in some places. Goff said it's possible to replenish Galveston Island's lost sand, but it's expensive. You've been listening to geophysicist John Goff of the University of Texas. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church and Foundation, a welcoming faith community that fosters spiritual exploration and works for social change. McKinley is committed to inclusiveness and welcomes all. 5th and John Streets on campus, on the web at www.mckinley-church.org.
It's 2 minutes.